Your generous response to these programs last year has encouraged the League for Political Education and the National Broadcasting Company to continue them. Like the town meeting of old, this rostrum is dedicated to free speech, honest debate, and a frank consideration of our common problems. Most of you know it, but for the benefit of our new listeners, let me explain that the League for Political Education is a nonpartisan, non-sectarian educational institution, now in its 43rd year. Through its programs of daily morning lectures held in this hall and through these broadcasts, it has received nationwide acclaim for its fair play and impartiality in the discussion of public questions. The National Broadcasting Company is, therefore, glad to join hands with the League again in its constructive and useful program as another feature of the 10th anniversary year of NBC. I now take pleasure in presenting to you the founder and director of America's Town Meeting of the Air, Mr. George V. Denny, Jr., the associate director of the League for Political Education, Mr. Denny.
Good evening, neighbors, and thank you, Mr. Havrilla. On behalf of the League, let me say that we're mighty glad to be back on the air again, and that we're everlastingly grateful to the National Broadcasting Company for the opportunity of opening the doors of Town Hall to a nationwide audience through your facilities. I want to take time for just a moment to read a telegram that means a great deal to me and a great deal to all of us. It's from the man who is really the co-founder and co-director of America's Town Meeting of the Air, Mr. John F. Royal, the head of the program department of the National Broadcasting Company. Here's the wire that just came in. Welcome back to your spot on the air. Your past performances assures a unique niche in radio's hall of outstanding programs. We salute you, Mr. Royal, on the 10th anniversary and extend to you our warmest congratulations on your achievement. Yes, we've tried to be fair, Mr. Havrilla, and we've tried to make these programs useful. And I assure you that one of the most helpful things about this whole project has been the splendid cooperation we've received from the audience here and throughout the country. More than half of our programs last year were suggested by members of the radio audience. We've already received a great many requests for speakers and subjects this year, and I think our program is shaping up in a most interesting way. Well, the campaign is over, and you, the people of America, have made your choice. But our problems are still with us. We are going to steer away from strictly political subjects in the immediate future, however, and turn to some of those deeply human matters which so vitally concern us all. Tonight, we are going to consider the question of public opinion, how it is formed, what it means to you and me, and to the welfare of civilization as a whole. We have announced as our subject public opinion and the town meeting idea. Our speakers are Miss Dorothy Thompson, in private life, Mrs. Sinclair Lewis, whose husband has had something to say on this subject in his recently dramatized novel, It Can't Happen Here. Miss Thompson is a celebrated journalist in her own right, columnist on the New York Herald Tribune, and is already well known to our town meeting audiences as she was one of the speakers who opened this program last season. Mr. Lawrence Dennis, also a former town meeting speaker, author of The Coming American Fascism, approaches this question from a slightly different angle. Mr. Dennis is sometimes called the number one fascist of America. He's just returned from an extensive tour of European capitals. I won't say which capitals. We are to hear next from Mr. Scott Nearing, a professor of economics, author of many books, who has also just returned from abroad, where he made a study of freedom of speech in foreign countries. Mr. Nearing is supposed to be at the opposite pole from Mr. Dennis. He is not, I believe, a communist. At least he's not a member of the Communist Party. But he does believe that there is much to be said for the philosophy and doctrines of the late Karl Marx. So he will approach this subject from a third point of view. And now we'll hear from our first speaker, Miss Dorothy Thompson. And at the close of her address and the addresses by Mr. Dennis and Mr. Nearing, we'll have questions from the audience. Now may I present Miss Dorothy Thompson. Miss Thompson.
The fundamental basis of all democratic government is the belief that man is a reasoning animal, and that he's endowed not only with a stomach, not only with instincts urging him towards food or towards love or hate, endowed not only with amorous or aggressive individual or tribal urges, but endowed also with a brain and with capacity for judgment. Unless you accept this thesis, making due allowances for congenital idiots, you might as well throw all democratic government out of the window and have done with it once and for all. You might as well start immediately thinking of government in terms of masses, not in terms of people. Of masses weighed by group prejudices, economic or racial or tribal, who through these urges and prejudices can be manipulated into any form which a few masterminds can conceive. But the logic of a belief in reason leads inevitably to self-government. Government, that is to say, by consent. Consent which is not given or withheld once in the selection of a policy or a leader, but given or withheld continually, constantly being amended by changes in judgment based upon increased experience or increased knowledge or changed conditions. The rule of the majority being fructified and corrected by an articulate minority free to speak its mind. Such a society whose authority rests in the long run upon consensus of opinion is dynamic. It is a society constantly in a state of revision, changing its structure and even its aims as it goes along. It is often not efficient. It often makes mistakes, but it doesn't socialize its mistakes and stabilize them. It's not very imposing often as organization, but it's less an organization anyhow than it is an organism. And the prime condition of health of that organism is that channels and instruments of public opinion should be kept open, that they should not be monopolized either by economic power or by government, and that they should not be abused by unscrupulous, dishonest, or too criminally ignorant men. The sensitivity of any democracy to assaults upon these instruments is the measure of its vigor and its determination to defend itself. Show me a country sensitive to coercion or abuse of free speech, and you will show me a country with sound democratic instincts. Show me a country indifferent to coercion or abuse of free speech, and I will see a country where democratic institutions are decaying. And show me a country where speech is monopolized, and I shall see a country that has abandoned or been robbed of faith in its capacity to govern itself. Not a dictatorship in the world today dares submit its policies and even its fundamental theories to public debate, which is the same as saying that every dictatorship must govern by the twin instruments of monopoly of propaganda and by force. And against such instruments, force, terror, and conspiracy are the only weapons. All modern dictatorships, regardless what they call themselves, are carried on under conditions of latent civil war. It doesn't matter how powerful they are. It doesn't matter how huge a majority they are able to carry with them, voluntarily or involuntarily. In all countries, under all conditions, governed by dictatorships and not governed by dictatorships, there is a minority in opposition to policy. And under dictatorship, that minority has no recourse except to conspiracy. One of the most fascinating documents of modern times is the official report of the recent trial of Zinoviev, Kamenev, and the other Trotskyists in Moscow. I am prepared to say, incidentally, that I do not accept that report as the final word on the fantastic Moscow trial. But the confessions revealed what? They reveal that in Russia, if one believes with all one's patriotic fervor that a course pursued by the government is erroneous, the inevitable and only thing that any opposition can do is to plot to remove the government by assassination. Appeals to reason are impossible. Recourse to public opinion is impossible. To attempt to build up a counter-movement for a change in policy is impossible. Therefore, every courageous minority becomes counter-revolutionary. The same thing has already happened in Germany. In the summer of 1934, Mr. Hitler, despite the immense support which he has in public opinion, was confronted by imminent civil war. And his only recourse was to cut off the heads of still uncounted numbers of his lieutenants. Are we to believe that this condition is an indication of strength? The justification for the centralization and monopoly of such power lies in a public realization of a state of crisis. Therefore, it's necessary for dictatorship to maintain a state of crisis, internal or external. The whole mythology upon which National Socialism is based would almost certainly disappear if German science were allowed to express itself freely. It couldn't stand up against the onslaughts against it of disinterested debate. The Russian program of intense and rapid collectivization of agriculture would not have stood up against public debate, and several million Russians would not have starved. In our whole history, there has never been a suppression, a government suppression, I would say, of free speech, except during a state of war. I am prepared to admit that there are moments of extreme crisis when the national existence of a people is at stake, when that fact will overweigh everything else and lead to a relinquishment of freedom to debate with the consent of almost the whole of public opinion. And even then, I bless the objective. But such relinquishments are made by democracies with strings attached. They are made for the duration of the war, and the first business of a people is to get back the right to public debate the moment the crisis is over. We are not threatened in this country by government suppression of discussion, although I may say we are threatened in this country by a barrage of government propaganda. The press agent attached to government is a new thing in this country and in most countries since the war. But apart from that, there is in this country a tremendous amount of abuse of free speech. And I don't know of any remedy to such abuse, except perhaps some better libel laws, and certainly more and better free speech. For the last few weeks, we have been listening and reading, a disgraceful amount of disingenuous, misleading, and irresponsible opinion. We have seen technical questions elevated into moral issues, and the facts about them distorted out of all recognition. The whole debate over the Social Security Act is typical. Here is an act passed by Congress with the collaboration of both parties, voted for by a majority of both Democrats and Republicans, which has been presented to the American working man as a plot to deprive him of part of his wages for the aggrandizement of a greedy Congress. A report prepared by the 20th Century Fund, a commission of experts, criticized technical provisions of the Act, and indeed I believe they are open to criticism. And the prestige and disinterestedness of the experts was used to convince the public that the Republican counter-proposals represented the same expert and disinterested opinion, as indeed they did not. At the same time, the Democratic campaign has consistently implied in most of its public utterances that the burden of a widely distributed system of public pensions plus insurances would be borne by the rich. And that isn't true either. The Republican attempt to present the Relief Administration as purely a political instrument of Mr. Farley were countered by Democratic accusations that all who do not agree with the present policy of Relief Administration are in favor of starving the unemployed. The distortion and suppression of news by many partisan newspapers during this campaign reached its apotheosis in Chicago, where Governor Landon and Mrs. Simpson shared the front pages of several newspapers, with Mr. Roosevelt only appearing occasionally very far inside. So that one of my friends suggested that probably many voters would write Mrs. Simpson's name in on the ballot. And the abuse of free speech reached an all-time low in our history, I should think, in the final address of the Reverend Father Coughlin. We weren't to be personal, were they? But isn't an open season on Father Coughlin? Who managed to accuse the president of attempting to destroy American freedom and the American Constitution, while at the same time the Reverend Father himself pled for Congress to secure an annual living wage for all workers, a program which it would be very interesting to submit to the Supreme Court. I would like to pay a few more respects to Father Coughlin, had not my colleague, Westbrook Pegler, said the last word on the subject yesterday afternoon. And yet, and in spite of all this, the campaign was not, I think, the result of it was not, I think, seriously to pervert American thinking, but greatly to discredit a large section of the American press. I am absolutely convinced that it is the most serious political mistake to attempt to talk down to the American people at this moment of our history. For an immense amount of genuine public education has been going on in this country. Education in public affairs, and for that the Open Forum certainly deserves a great deal of credit. Desirable above all, to my mind, is the revival of debate and the encouragement of the public heckler. The radio, even in countries where it's not controlled, has serious disabilities. It entrenches the one-way speech. The listener at the fireside cannot publicly question the statements that he hears. They're made to several million hearers without the slightest danger of public contradiction. It may be that radio is partly responsible for the exit of debate in political dispute. I remember that when this country was once in a condition of serious internal crisis, at one of the times when it was at the crossroads, as it so often is, Mr. Lincoln and Mr. Douglas took to the stump and fought the issues out before the people of the nation in each other's presence, where every statement they made could be challenged. And that, those debates, of course, belong to the great American document. That technique is now reserved to speakers in public forums, before the Foreign Policy Association, and in these town meetings of the air. But it's a technique which desperately needs further revival. In the next 4 years, we shall face a great many considerable problems. If Tuesday's election means anything more than a vote for a distinguished personality with great powers of leadership, and I'm sure that it does mean more, it means that the people of this country have demanded techniques of government and government collaboration with business and industry and labor, which will assure the people of more stable incomes, insurance against economic risks, conservation, and rebuilding. The means of achieving these objectives will be matters of the greatest public importance. I may say that the world, the universe, is really divided into two classes of people, meansers and enders. And I am one of those who calls herself a meanser. I think that the means by which you arrive at an objective, at a goal, are perhaps more important than the goal itself, because I think the means determine the end rather than the other way around. So the means of achieving these objectives will be matters of very great public importance. Legislative and executive action can occur in an atmosphere of intelligent criticism and widespread public debate, or they can be foisted by pressure groups upon a confused and ill-informed people to enhance the opportunities for the former and diminish the practice of the latter, is, I take it, one service of this town meeting of the air, and I think also that it is one of the noblest services that can be rendered at this time by those who still believe in the power of human reason. Thank you.
Waiting here, a slightly different point of view from Mr. Lawrence Dennis. Mr. Dennis.
Mr. Moderator, ladies and gentlemen, free speech is essentially a luxury. The extent to which a community can indulge in this luxury is relative and not absolute. It is relative to the minimum requirements of public safety in a given situation, as these requirements may be judged by those in charge of the state. The big social problem in this respect is that of creating the circumstances or mechanisms for free discussion with a minimum danger of abuse by selfish individuals and minority groups. But it must be kept in mind that the strength of the state and the security of its situation mainly determine the extent to which the luxury of free speech can be enjoyed. Historically, There has never been any such thing as absolute freedom of speech. No one is legally free to cry fire in a crowded hall. The essential reasons why it is permissible to cry communist at Mr. Roosevelt and why it is not permissible to cry fire in this hall tonight is that although both cries are equally false, the one was calculated only to discredit those who raised it and give Mr. Roosevelt the biggest political victory in our history, while the other, the cry of fire, would be calculated only to produce a panic. It is the effect, the probable effect of an utterance which determines its character. In the situation or circumstances of war or social revolution, as Ms. Thompson has remarked, that is all a great curtailment of free speech, especially as to ends or objectives. For instance, during the American Revolution, some 60,000 American colonists, among the best people in their respective communities, who remained loyal to the mother country, were hounded from these shores by political persecution, legal confiscation of their property, and mob violence, usually instigated by the leading spirits in the American town meetings of that epoch. The nascent American Republic was not at that moment sufficiently strong or secure to tolerate American colonists hostile to the purposes of the American Revolution. Tonight, on a public platform and in a nationwide hookup, I am allowed to say with emphasis that we were very foolish as a nation to enter the World War on the side of the Allies or on any other side in 1917. I thought the same in 1917, though I went to France in the infantry. But had I then said as much in public, I should have been sent to prison for 5 or 10 years, along with many others, who were so disloyal as to criticize their country's war aims in time of war. In this country, as in most others, there is full freedom to denounce past and future wars and a prison sentence for denouncing a present war. The reason, of course, is that denunciation of past and future wars is largely academic, like Mr. Norman Thomas's denunciation of capitalism, Mr. Landon's denunciation of the New Deal, or Secretary Hull's denunciation of high tariffs. Denunciation of a war while it is going on would be dangerous to public safety. Hence, it is never permitted. In several European countries today, social revolutions with marked war features are in court. In these countries, there flourishes the same repression of free discussion that characterized the American Revolution and the American crusade to make the world pay for democracy in 1917. Tonight, however, we are not concerned with freedom of speech and discussion in foreign countries or with freedom of speech in past or future American revolutions or wars. We are interested in free discussion in the United States during a period of peace and peaceful evolution, which we hope will be prolonged. We are especially interested in the role of a town meeting of the air in facilitating such discussion. Taking this view of the problem, we may well ask, what are our ideals in the matter of free discussion, and wherein can the town meeting of the air serve the realization of these ideals? Well, it seems clear to me that our fundamental ideal is the maximum enjoyment of the luxury of free discussion with the minimum danger to public safety. If you ask why we should cherish this ideal, some people, Ms. Thompson, undoubtedly will reply, because free discussion is the best way to arrive at truth. I find this reply, however, somewhat unsatisfactory, because I observe in the world today so many contradictory propositions which are held in different countries and even in the same country by different people, all to be self-evident truths. So I am forced to the conclusion that truth is relative rather than absolute, and that public discussion must be instrumental to the realization of some one idealized scheme of social order in some one country, rather than conducted with a view to arriving at an answer to Pilate's famous question, what is truth? It seems intellectually more honest merely to say that we should indulge in the luxury of free discussion as much as the demands of public safety will allow, simply because it is an agreeable luxury which enriches our civilization just as literature and music enriches. Free discussion gives us an opportunity to clarify our objectives, rationalize our emotional urges, air our grievances, and compare critically the fittest means to desired ends. I think nothing is gained by claiming for free discussion merits which it can never possess. For instance, free discussion can never settle disputes as to ultimate value, as to whether objective A is better than objective B, or whether it is better to play golf than to play bridge, or whether grand opera is preferable to jazz. The great danger in connection with indulgence in this luxury of free discussion is that of abuse of power by individuals and minority groups. It is this danger which the town meeting seems best suited to curb. On a small island or in an Athenian city-state where all the inhabitants could assemble in one meeting place and where each inhabitant qualified to express his views could do so freely, the dangers of abuse of power by an individual or a group would be considerably less than in our complex modern society, in which every individual cannot hire a hall, pay for time over the air, or get his opinions published in the newspapers, periodicals, or in book form. In the small community, if it is small enough, every individual can have his say. In the large modern state, the most we can hope for is an opportunity for every important idea to be set forth under conditions of comparative equality. The town meeting seems to be an excellent device for this purpose. I like the town meeting idea because it permits of a large measure of social regulation and obviates some of the cruder abuses of propaganda and mass suggestion for private and minority group purposes. The town meeting might be compared to a legalized prize fight or athletic contest held under proper supervision. This is quite a different matter from attacks by individual pugilists or bands of pugilists on whomsoever they might see fit to assail or challenge to an encounter under no proper supervision. There are conditions under which the best pugilist can be allowed to do his stuff. There are conditions under which the best advocate of communism or the ablest propagandist for a special interest may be allowed to argue his case without menacing public order. The town hall of the air may present these conditions. But there are conditions under which the preaching of communism or special pleading for minority group interests may be dangerous to public safety, even in normal peace times. The point I wish to make here is that there can be no good case for the absolute right of any individual or group to carry on propaganda subject to no public regulation or social control. The statement of conflicting theses by competent exponents of each, under good Marquess of Queensberry rule, may be in the public interest at certain times. On the other hand, I have no hesitation in joining with Miss Thompson in wishing to curb clever agitators who work among ignorant and unfortunate people with a view to fanning the flames of class hatred and inciting to ultimate civil war, whether in the name of Marxian communism or some more homespun variety of demagogic populism. There is a propaganda and free speech problem, but it is one which ought to be discussed in realistic terms in relation to current needs, and not in relation to conditions of the horse and buggy day. The essence of the problem is promoting the widest and freest public discussion under safe conditions, while at the same time curbing dangerous and irresponsible uses of propaganda, whether by a millionaire newspaper owner or a preacher with a good radio voice, in ways calculated to stir up class hatred and incite to violence. The town hall of the air is one of the most constructive mechanisms developed during the past 10 years to contribute to the solution of this ultra-modern social problem.
Thank you, Mr. Dennis.
We are listening to America's Town Meeting of the Air, coming to you from Town Hall in New York City. Back in historic Town Hall, New York, for the continuation of America's Town Meeting of the Air. Our moderator, Mr. George B. Denny, Jr., will continue with the program. Mr. Denny.
We've just heard from Miss Dorothy Thompson and Mr. Lawrence Dennis. And now we have a third speaker on this subject, from a third point of view, Mr. Scott Nearing. Mr. Nearing.
Mr. Dennis described free speech as a luxury. I believe that from an idealistic, utopian point of view, at least, it should be considered a necessity. First, because individuals who have a chance to express themselves benefit through free speech or through discussion. And second, because the guidance of public affairs, the direction of public affairs, is helped rather than hindered by an airing of the issues involved in the conduct of those affairs. But however we may feel about these issues, in Europe and America today, we face a very serious and, from some points of view, a very disadvantageous reality. Millions of people in Europe who want to speak their minds on public questions are now being gagged and muzzled. The people of the United States are rapidly coming to face the same issue. Granted that public discussion is desired by those who can express themselves in public and is appreciated by those who vote and listen while others express themselves in public. Granted that public discussion is desirable as a means of self-expression and as a method of guiding the conduct of public affairs, then the question is, what measures can we take or should we take, given the present situation in which we find ourselves, to guarantee, to safeguard, to make possible a larger range of public discussion for a larger number of people? Public opinion is a variable social compound. In a mature, stable society like ours, its component elements are somewhat as follows. Custom and tradition, four parts. Cold storage plants and boilerplate factories of the vested interest, five parts. Public discussion, one part. In our society, therefore, we can anticipate that public discussion under normal conditions will play about a 10% part in the formation of public opinion. These component elements in public opinion vary with the forms of society, with the stages of its maturity, and with the internal and external stresses and strains to which it is subject at particular periods. In primitive frontier communities, Public discussion is carried on as a matter of course. In a complex, expanding social order, it is considered a necessity by the ruling class, a comfort by the middle class, and a luxury permitted at times to the masses on those occasions and in those places where its exercise will not seriously interfere with the privileges of the ruling class. In a declining society, public discussion becomes a contracting, vestigial practice that is progressively forbidden to the masses and to the middle class, and is ultimately denied even to members of the ruling class. With each increase in internal or external social friction and tension, public discussion is automatically curtailed. These variations, or these types of variations in public discussion, can be met with in the recent history of the United States. The town meeting held in a general store or a schoolhouse or a town hall was a commonplace of the American frontier. It is still a going concern in many of the smaller New England villages. It has never played any important part in the public life of commercial or industrial cities, and consequently the urban development that accompanied the industrialization of the United States gradually eliminated the town meeting as a form for the expression and formation of public opinion. American capitalist economy matured between 1870 and 1910. This maturity included technical advances, the concentration of industrial control, the rise of the great banking syndicates, and the emergence of a group of power-conscious big businessmen. The period is commonly referred to as the era of trust building. From the standpoint of public discussion, it was made significant by the efforts of liberal politicians such as Bryan and La Follette, and of vigorous journalists such as Ida Tarbell, Ray Stannard Baker, and Lincoln Steffens, to modify public opinion by critical discussion on the platform and through the press. The maturing ruling class in the United States in this era of trust building took over the agencies of public discussion for the same reason that it took over timber tracts, factories, railroads, and banks: because they were an asset in the protection of ruling class privileges and in the building of ruling class power. The aggressive attacks on the malefactors of great wealth that began in the late 19th century reached their high point in the muckraking campaign conducted by Everybody's, McClure's, Pearson's, the Metropolitan, and the American Magazine at about the turn of the century. The consequent regimentation of discussion in the public press began about 1905. First, postal regulations were so altered that undesirable publications could be excluded from second-class mailing privileges, and under certain circumstances, excluded bodily from the mail. Second, the magazines of protest were either bought outright by the big interests or were wrecked through the organized withdrawal of advertising. Third, great publication syndicates like those of Scripps, Hearst, and McFadden were built up to occupy the publication field. And fourth, the popular writers were paid huge fees and salaries to write what the vested interests behind the publication syndicates wanted the public to read. Drastic limitations on public discussion as a factor in the formation of American public opinion had already been imposed by 1910. The war crisis of 1916-18 involved an increase of internal and external social tension that was eagerly seized upon by the ruling class and used as an excuse for further limitations on public discussion. The federal espionage law, together with a crop of state sedition acts and of local police regulations, drastically curtailed those forms of public discussion that were regarded as inimical to the interests of the ruling class. College presidents cleared out their radical professors. Radical publications were suppressed. It was 100% Americanism or nothing. The decline of the United States economy is still in its earliest stages. The social decay that is so obvious in parts of Central Europe is as yet only slightly evident in the United States. Nevertheless, the effects of decline and decay are already apparent in the restrictions imposed upon public discussion. Campaigns for Americanization, the requirement of teachers' oath, academic lockstep, the forcible suppression by mob violence of public meetings even during presidential campaigns, together with the sporadic and periodic manhunting of the Red, carry with them the definite promise of more to come. And when it does happen here, public discussion will be systematically extirpated, and public opinion will be deliberately manufactured in an official lie factory with the comfortable title of Ministry of Propaganda. Individual discussion is helpful. Public discussion is important and vital. Let us therefore discuss as we may, publicly while it is still possible, privately and secretly when it becomes necessary. But without illusion, a declining society such as that in which we live in the United States will progressively restrict the area of public discussion. The American ruling class, under the stress of historic forces, which it obviously cannot control, is retreating from the higher level of economic internationalism to the lower level of economic nationalism, and is liquidating a large portion of the middle class, lowering the standard of living of the working masses, and reducing a whole section of the community, the unemployed and unemployable population surplus, to economic and social pariahship. The people cling to their American standard of living. Like their European fellow humans, they will resist every effort to lower their level of well-being. Driven by historic necessity and confronted by mass resistance, the ruling class in the United States will follow the accepted European practice, declare a state of emergency, and deny public discussion of the issues involved. An enlargement of the area of public discussion cannot be expected during a period of social decline. Those who live in a declining society and who believe that public discussion is a desirable means of forming public opinion must turn their energies to the task of replacing the outmoded, declining social system by a new, expanding social order. Public discussion will flower again in the United States only during a new culture epoch. Only as we are able to reach a new culture level, only as we are able to organize and maintain a stable, classless society, only as we develop a cooperative world economy, only as we build a human-wide social order based on mutual aid, can we hope to secure a reversal of the processes which are progressively throttling public discussion in our declining society. The attainment of a new culture level, and that alone, will ensure any considerable increase in public discussion and any considerable control by the masses of the population over the formation of public opinion.
Finds it very difficult not to get into this argument himself. But rather than do that, I'm going to give the speakers a chance to get back at each other just before we take the questions, if they'll make it brief. Miss Thompson, perhaps you have some comments you'd like to make on the speeches made by Mr. Dennis and Mr. Nearing. Miss Thompson? Come on.
Well, I should like to say to Mr. Dennis that I did not say that the result of public discussion was to establish truth. I said that the result of public discussion was to establish consent, to bring about consent, that is to say, to get the largest possible, the most universal possible opinion as to what the greatest number of people consider truth to be. And what they consider the values to be by which they order their lives. It's a little different. As for Mr. Nearing, to whom I listened with great interest and attention, I wish I could have his faith in waiting for a classless society, or even in working for a classless society. Because I don't know of any classless society that's ever existed outside of the cemetery.
Oh, Mr. Dennis, maybe you'd like to say something to Miss Thompson and to Mr. Nearing. Dennis?
I'm indebted to Miss Thompson for her clarification of her view as to the purpose of discussion, not being that of determining truth, but rather obtaining assent. I would only interpose the observation there that discussion usually doesn't lead to assent, but to violent dissent. So I adhere to my original criteria that the discussion is a luxury. It's a social and cultural luxury which I'm in favor of. The criticism I would make of Miss Thompson's general thesis is that she didn't face or come to grips with the question of how to have discussion under safe conditions or to establish criteria. Now that is the vital question so far as discussion is concerned. We have a great deal of discussion that is safe, and there are conditions under which it is unsafe. I think those are realities that we have to cope with, and they can very easily be obscured by a lot of pleasant verbiage about the beauties of free speech and discussion. We must have responsible discussion or safe discussion, and we must avoid unsafe and dangerous discussion, which is possible in a democracy. Mr. Nearing's speech, of course, was essentially a good communistic evangelical speech. And I am always full of admiration for so able a communist as Mr. Nearing, though I cannot extend that admiration to some of his sympathizers in the audience. I don't think that communism has very much to say in an American or a democratic country about free discussion, because communism as a working phenomena is characterized by an entire suppression of free discussion. I'm willing to acknowledge or to grant that communism is in a revolutionary phase at present, and while the revolution goes on, there can be no free discussion. I think that's true in any revolution. The only point I make there is this, that while the American Revolution was eventually won, I don't think the Communist Revolution can ever be won. In other words, communism offers a perpetual revolution. I am quite realistic about free discussion, and I think intellectually honest, even if not entirely pleasing to some members of the audience in my views. I recognize that free discussion is not possible in wartime or in time of revolution. So I don't criticize communism for not having free discussion during its revolution. I merely criticize communism as being a formula of social organization which requires perpetual revolution. And that, I think, is bad.
All right, Mr. Nearing, it's your turn.
It's too bad, Mr. Dennis, that the world has to go on changing, but change it does. And as it has changed, there have always been people like Mr. Dennis who have talked about order and the maintenance and stabilization of the thing that is. And there have always been people like Miss Thompson who really lack faith in the possibilities of what might be. And I'd like to offer Miss Thompson again the great boon, both personally and socially, of the faith in the possibilities of a much better social order than that in which we live. And I'd like to offer Mr. Dennis a vigorous and determined resistance to any type of regimentation that he or anybody else chooses to impose here in the United States.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Nairn. Now we're ready for the questions from the audience. There are over 1,500 people gathered here in Town Hall, and among them a number of distinguished guests from abroad, officials of the broadcasting companies in 15 foreign countries. Have come to New York this month to participate in the celebration of the National Broadcasting Company's 10th anniversary. A number of these broadcasting officials are in our audience this evening. We are particularly happy to welcome them here to Town Hall. This subject may have been of special interest to some of these European broadcasters, and if you gentlemen, guests of the National Broadcasting Company, have any questions you'd like to ask first, before we go on with the question period, let's have them, please. Will you rise and state your name and where you're from? Yes? Yes, sir.
Arthur Burroughs.
Mr. Burroughs?
Secretary General of the International Broadcasting Union from Geneva.
Yes, sir.
May I put a question to Miss Thompson?
To Miss Thompson? Yes.
Miss Thompson, I gather, is not altogether happy concerning the technique of the use of radio in electoral campaigns. This being so, and seeing that radio is established amongst the public services, what modification in the technique of political broadcasting would Miss Thompson propose for application in future campaigns?
Miss Thompson, what about broadcasting regulations in future campaigns? Well, that's for the broadcast.
That's a very hard question, of course. It may sound very outrageous of me, but I would like to see the laws of libel made stronger in the United States. That's one thing. Then I would like, it's very difficult. I don't think it can be organized by radio. I have no quarrel with the broadcasting system. I have a quarrel with the demand of the public. I don't see any way to get at it except that way. I like this idea very much. I like the idea of responsible debate. I wish that the broadcasting companies and other people would try and foster actual debate on the air. Perfectly true, as somebody said in the earlier part of this discussion, before we began to speak, when the audience was speaking, that nobody answered anybody in this campaign. Not a human being answered another human being. Not a speaker answered another speaker. I would like to see that done, but I don't think it's the business of the broadcasting companies. I don't see how they can do it, how they can organize it. I think it's the business of a demand from the part of the public.
Next question. Any more questions from the broadcasters? No? All right, questions from the general audience. Questions? Balcony, yes, sir? From the balcony.
My impression is that the question tonight is a
question
to whom you or to Miss Thompson.
To Miss Thompson.
I'll ask the question direct. Do you not think that the press is fast losing out as a molder of public opinion? Or indeed as a fair representative of it, losing out to the radio.
As a molder of public opinion, Miss Thompson.
I think it is, but I think it's very large in the form of press.
All right, another question over there.
I'd like to ask Mr. Dennis a question.
Mr. Dennis.
Can you describe specifically the circumstances whereby the safety of the public would be endangered by the exercise of freedom of speech?
That's very easy to answer. If you send a skillful, passionate agitator into an area that's highly inflamed over a strike or over some serious political disturbance, and preach violence, you can very easily, by the preaching of communism or the preaching of any kind of class hatred, you can very easily lead to disorder. Whereas you can get up in an audience of this kind and expound almost any political or social theory, including pure anarchy, without any danger. But if you incite people who are already very angry, for whatever the reasons may be, to disregard law and do as they please, why, you may create a social crisis. That's all.
All right. Let's come to ask Mr. Dennis a question.
I'd like to ask Mr. Dennis a question. That's all this time. Mr. Dennis is a good fascist. I'd like to ask him whether he thinks that Mr. Hitler's speech at Nuremberg recently was calculated in the interest of public order, whether he thinks that often has been suppressed, and if so, by whom?
Why, we're not discussing any foreign political systems or governments.
All right. The young lady down here. Young lady?
Yes.
Your question ready?
Mr. Dennis. I would like to know what criteria would make a discussion safe.
What criteria would make discussion safe? He's just been speaking about
it. I think I covered that. It's the criteria, it's the result. If the advocacy of any particular set of
political ideas on this platform simply provides the luxury of an intellectual diversion and education. Why, it comes. If those utterances, however, under other conditions, incited people to acts of violence, then it's unsafe and should not be allowed. That is the criteria.
Here's the question that's just been handed in. Mr. Nearing, the government is organizing through the Department of Education public forums all over the United States. Do you think that such discussion groups should be under government control? Mr. Nearing.
In general, governments are dangerous. And one should deal with grave suspicion any attempt by government to mold public opinion. On the other hand, since the government already presumes to mold public opinion through the public school system and other educational agencies, there's no question at all but that debate programs and discussion programs and forums and the like are an extremely valuable element in such public education.
Next question.
Watkins, New York.
Yes, sir, Mr. Watkins.
Mr. Dennis, please.
Mr. Dennis.
Do you think that fascism is international anarchy?
Do you think that fascism is international anarchy?
No, I don't. But why bring up fascism in public discussion? Now, we're talking tonight about public discussion. I don't think fascism is international anarchy. No, far from it. I don't think even communism is international anarchy.
All right, my dear. Yes? Arthur Fane, Brooklyn. Mr. Dennis. You have spoken a great deal about communism, and it seems you have it on the mind.
We have one on the platform.
Aside from communism, strikes, or any other agitation, can you mention any specific situation where freedom of speech would do any harm to the public safety?
I think I've covered that already. There are hundreds of situations in which incitement to violence and to hatred might do harm. It's very easy to find those situations.
Yes, Mr. Dennis really has spoken on that same question before. Yes, Mr. Bates, question?
Mr. Dennis, who in this opinion would be the drafters of the Queensbury rules he talked about, and who would decide the occasions when they should be enforced?
Why, on this platform, I could wish for none better than Mr. Denny himself as the umpire.
Thank you, Mr. Dennis. Well, I'd fare all right under fascism if Lawrence Dennis were the dictator. There's a lady down here with a question.
I wanted to ask Mr. Dennis whether what's happened in Europe can't happen here.
Mr. Dennis, whether what happened in Europe can't happen here.
I'll read Mr. Lewis's book. I hope it doesn't happen here. But anything can happen anywhere.
Well, here we are, almost at the end of the hour, with more questions than we can possibly handle. It's been our purpose is never to give you final answers to the complex subjects we discuss. If they were not difficult and many-sided problems, we'd not have them on this program. But we believe that by having them discussed by competent authorities on the same platform the same evening, you will be given much valuable material that will be the basis for your own discussion. Then your conclusions will be your own. We know that a great many of you listen as members of groups, large and small, throughout the country, and that you follow up our meetings with discussions of your own and with relevant reading. We have arranged again to have these broadcasts published, and each week a list of books or pamphlets relating to the subject under discussion will be included in these publications. And now Mr. Havrilla will tell you how you can obtain copies of tonight's broadcast. Mr. Havrilla.
Arrangements have been made with one of America's leading publishing houses to print copies of all the broadcasts in this series, including the principal speeches and all questions and answers of the fallen period. If you want a copy of tonight's broadcast or a list of broadcasts as tentatively scheduled to follow, send your request directly to the League for Political Education, the Town Hall, 123 West 43rd Street, New York City. Let me repeat the address. The League for Political Education. The Town Hall, 123 West 43rd Street, New York City. The list of broadcasts will be sent free, and a printed copy of what has been said here tonight will be sent at a nominal cost of 10 cents. Next week at this hour, our subject for discussion will be, Do We Need Uniform Divorce and Marriage Laws? The speakers will be the Honorable George Gordon Battle, attorney, Dr. Henry Pratt Fairchild, sociologist of New York University, Miss Benita Shelton Matthews, Washington attorney and noted feminist leader, and Miss Jane H. Todd, member of the New York State of Assembly.
Do we need uniform divorce?
This is the National Broadcasting Company.